You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC, located on the unceded traditional Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam people.
Hello and welcome to the Gender Empowerment Collective podcast. My name is Randy.
I'm Chimgi.
I'm Anastasia.
And we are three friends who attend classes at UBC, and we are here to discuss topics that we have covered in our classes and that we see in our day-to-day lives. However, we are not the experts in these topics, which is why we are bringing in a guest who knows more than we do. Today, we will be having a conversation about cultural appropriation, with a focus on racist Asian Halloween costumes. All right, so let's get started. Let's start with just a brief overview about how we all think about cultural appropriation.
The way I personally see cultural appropriation is when I think I started talking before my thoughts actually started, but the line for me between appreciation and appropriation is when you're using the outfit, object, whatever it is, like out of its context, like completely. Like when you see like traditional Asian garb being worn just as, or like being made into just fast fashion outfits that are just short and they're just called Oriental, whatever, skirt, dress, something like that, that to me then is appropriation because you're not appreciating it for what it's used for.
I think there's also, just to build on that, a lot of the conversations I've had about cultural appropriation focus on like who's getting the money. So it's a lot of like who's getting wealth from the culture. And I think like when we think about racist Halloween costumes, like you wearing it, like you're supporting the person who appropriated that culture to make that costume. And like I think, and especially like this is not costumes, but think about jewelry, like buying jewelry or art from an artist within that culture is very different.
I think that puts, that's a big part, is just like understanding the purpose of it, the intent, like, and even like doing that research and making sure that you're buying something from an artist who's actually a part of the culture. And then I think a big, just like a glaring one for the difference between appreciation and appropriation is just respect, right? Like, how is it being done? Is it being done to mock the other, like, culture that you're wearing the clothes from? Then obviously that's appropriation.
Definitely for the Halloween costumes, it's like the most, it's so blatant.
Yeah.
And yet, I mean, like, white people don't want to acknowledge it at all.
Yeah.
But like, I think just for the definition for me, I guess definitely I think about the money, like, who's getting the money, like, when it turns, and also like kind of erasing its history, like, the specific history, like, they might know, oh, this is a Native American thing, but they'll never know the tribe and they'll never know the meaning, and it's been completely like taken away from that person, and also that person isn't profiting from them, you know, stealing their artwork or their designs and their the things that they make. So
I think that leads into the other question that we had, is just discussing why there seems to be not a lot of movement in our society, especially from white people, to acknowledge the cultural appropriation that is happening, especially around, I think we all see on social media around Halloween, there's so many activists that are constantly talking about this, but yet there's still these costumes that are for sale. There's still people that wear blackface on Halloween. There's still people that show up to Halloween parties dressed in these costumes. Yeah. So there seems to be just a complete lack. So I'm curious to know, like, what we think about that. Why is there not any pressure for ourselves to address it?
I think for like for white people, I always think as a non-white person from the outside, I guess, I always think like there's no incentive, right, for white people to understand, to kind of police themselves in that way. That's something that that to them, I think, feels like they're taking on an extra task. You know, they're doing something that's kind of maybe to some people's perspectives, like unnecessary, right? Because it's not offending them, it's not affecting them.
Yeah. I mean, we live in a white supremacist society, so there is no, like, we're not harmed by cultural appropriation. So there's not incentive for us to be like, hey, this is affecting us. And we see that a lot with any kind of action that's called for us to take. Like, it's a lot of like, well, it doesn't affect me personally. Like, what do I have at stake? Mm-hmm. And really being able to look and be like, oh, like, it's not always about me. And I think a lot of people just don't have that ability.
It's not about me. Like, I think about how like dreads and like black hairstyles, like there's been more like of an outcry from like the black community, like for white people and like non-black people to do those hairstyles. And I was thinking, but with Halloween costumes, I think white people are like, can I be racist for one day? I don't get racist all the other days of the year. And like, I mean, I went to a thrift store today and I saw like little kids in these Asian costumes, like the Asian costumes for little kids. And I mean, I live in Ontario. It's definitely for white kids. And I think it's, and they, I mean, white people don't think it's important enough that, and I think also they want to get away with it. I think like, I think the ones that buy these costumes, like, you know, and yeah, people call them out on it, but they don't take it seriously.
Yeah. I think like a lot of the times people will say like, even for something, I don't know if you guys seen like the fox eye trend that was on like TikTok and it was on Instagram, and then a lot of makeup artists were doing it. So it's where you like make your eyes like appear slanted. And some girls were doing like the gesturing with it too, where they were like pulling their eyes back. And then there was a lot of like different like Asian like influencers that I follow, like they posted about it and they were like, this is offensive. Like, this is how people used to ridicule and mock us for the way that, for our eye shape, right? But a lot of the comments, like, or like just the response from the people who were doing these actions were like, we're just like appreciating it, or like, we think it looks nice. Like, you should take it as a compliment. You know what I mean? And that was like enraging, right? Like, you can't, when someone is saying something to you, you can't say, just take it as a compliment.
Yeah, like, it's they can't see how their smaller actions build up to like the oppression of a person, because like, we're gonna get into like what is the effect of this, but it's clear that like white people don't see the effect, because I guess from their perspective it's one day, it's one trend, like and they don't have like the wherewithal,
right?
Or they just don't care. I think
it's like they don't realize how long these, like, these things last, right? Like, the kids being mocked for their eyes, like, that doesn't just go away. Like, that doesn't roll off your back. Like, that sticks with you, right? And you carry that with you, like, as long as you are in this, like, not as long as you are, I think just for the rest of your life, right? So it's not a small thing. And for, like, Asians to see other, like, Asian costumes out there that are just, like we were talking about this, where it's, like, on Amazon, you can buy costumes that are literally just like Asian girl, Asian woman, Asian man, and they're all just wearing like what white people think is Asian culture, right? Like chopsticks in the hair, which is insane, because nobody puts their eating utensils in their hair, except for maybe like Ariel, right? Like, that's insane.
Yeah.
So when you see that in stores, right, you see yourself as a costume. Because I feel like white people have never experienced that. They don't understand what it feels like and how that will stay with you.
Yeah, I think that's super true. And talking about what you said before, Anastasia, like relating it to power, like again, in a white supremacist society, white people hold the power, and there's not a lot of incentive. A lot of people don't want to let that go, even though that's a whole nother conversation that that is not part of it. Yeah. But it's like to be able to, in their minds, kind of put this culture, and I say that like very inaccurate because it's so diverse. I mean, it's a continent. Like it's there's so many countries, there's so many different groups of people that live there, that for us to just like be in our little bubble in Canada, and like wherever you live in Canada, then, you know, I have family that's never left Southern Alberta. Like their entire existence has been in that area. So to them, it's, they just want to like categorize it and say, oh, that's what an Asian person looks like. That's what an Asian person wears. And that's so not accurate, but it's, I think we find this very gross comfort in simplifying everything in our life and in the world.
Yeah, people fear like what they don't know, like that's and then that's racism. And so,
I think what you were saying about like simplification, like when you do look at this like continent of people and you decide that they're all one and you put them all in one group, like it is so much easier to write them off then, because you don't see them as individuals. It's so much easier to make judgments about them if you're not thinking of them as like people, you know, but just
like then the costumes, like I don't know, it reminds me of like when serial killers like cut someone's face off and wear it, like it just feels like you just want to put on a culture and like not care whatever that like that that's a person and just wear it for, to get drunken. And also you're sexualizing a culture, like people, and like, and that's so it's definitely like sick.
So I guess what I wanted to talk about was, and I guess we briefly did touch on it, is just like the implications of just having these costumes, like what that says about us in Canada, in the US, that has. I mean, like, as I said, like before the, just like seeing those costumes in person, like for me personally, like I saw it and I just like, I brush it off, right? I'm like, oh, that's trash, right? Like the store is trash, you know, that's all I think. But I think it sticks and you don't notice it.
It's interesting that like no store is against it, like, and we wouldn't expect any store or like brand to be like, we're not for this, like I guess that just shows how like it's kind of showing that like when you walk into a store, like they support like, you know, simplifying and like objectifying like a culture, and it's just like
I think what I, because like year after year, I see these costumes, right? And you always hear like, see these pictures come up of like whatever, some teens or like adults wearing them. And like, I wonder like why there isn't more like of a pushback, you know? Is it because it only happens one day a year, that it's not sustained for long enough for us to like, you know, get mad, right? Like, why aren't we being like, take these costumes out? Like no one's making these demands, and that's kind of confusing to me because it happens year after year, you know?
Yeah. And I think even like the argument that people can make that it, oh, it's only one day a year, but it's not, because we see like the cultural appropriation that happens on Halloween is reflected in our media. It's reflected in our music. It's reflected in the movies that we watch, the books that we read, like even just the clothing that we buy, like, I think that it's much more stark and noticeable, perhaps you could say, on Halloween, but a lot of people do make that argument, but it's just, it's not true. Like it's, and especially like for people who are people of color, like it's always noticeable them. It's just like, as a white person, it's maybe not noticeable to you all the time because you're not the one directly impacted by that. So you can pretend that, oh, that's, you know, it's just one day a year. It's on Halloween. We can talk about it then. And yeah, I don't know. It's, but it's so much wider. Like, it's everywhere.
That's true. Yeah.
I think that, like, the fact that they teach, like, I think unfortunately the fact that it is one day of year, this specific issue.
Yeah.
Like, costumes does make white people completely forget it. Like, they don't even know what Halloween is or something. And then it comes up. I mean, only from, but I think also it's because it might stem in childhood. Like, I'm thinking of how there's cowboys and Indians and how kids dressed up as that. And that was so popular, especially in, like, the 50s. And and like, that, and clearly, like, they wanted to be the cowboys. And then I think, so people are like, I guess they see, like, oh, I did this as a child. My grand, like, it's like they're trying to protect something that, yeah. And also it's kind of gross that it is taught to kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a nostalgia kind of thing.
Right.
Nostalgic racism.
Yeah.
Alive and well. Dude, that's a lot of white culture. I really feel like nostalgic racism is like a big part of white culture.
I mean, it's so accurate. Like, when I'll go back and watch shows and music that my dad played for me when I was a kid, and I'll just be like, did you really think that this was like progressive when it came out in the 70s? Because
I think, oh, well, when I was thinking of nostalgic racism, I just thought, like, it's fun. Like, they're thinking it's fun. And, like, they want to, because, like, it's just celebrating racism. So they think it's, I don't know. And then that's also, like, we were talking, like, the Queen's party, which was almost everybody in that dressed up as something racist. They all got the men. They all came to the party.
Yeah, it was diverse. And it was diverse representation too. They had a lot of different ethnic groups represented in their costuming.
And I don't know what word, I don't know how to put into words on a radio show. Why that's so.
Yeah, for real. I think we honestly, like, I feel like there should be some sort of boycott of, like, Halloween costume stores just to bring it back, because, like, they should be held accountable. They've been doing this for so long, right? And every year they get away with it. Like, honestly, like, people should just be like, everyone's already on that, like, DIY wave, right? So, like, let's all, nobody, you know what I mean? Like, nobody go to those stores. Yeah, then to me, I'm like, I wonder what your relationship is with, like, when Asian issues come to the forefront, or they come around, like, what do you do? How do you act, right? Because if you have this, like, whatever Asian character tattoo on you, or if your house is decorated, like, Oriental to the max, right? Like, what do you do for the culture? You know what I mean? Like, if you are taking so much for it, from it, like, what do you give back? So if you're, like, if you have those tattoos, and then you're also racist, right, to Asian people, or you also, like, describe, I don't know, or use, like, messed up language about them, right? Like, how do you negotiate that in your head? Like, how are you those two different people at once? I think that's so strange to me that you can
be
both. Yeah.
It's definitely just taking the people away. I feel like white people, like, they see Asian culture and Asian people in separate, like, they, like, they can, like, make fun of Asian people as kids, but then love Chinese food on the weekends and, like, Bruce Lee or Asian movies or whatever, but, like, it's, like, one side of the brain or something to them, and it's not. Yeah, definitely boycott Halloween costumes. Like, that should definitely
That's the takeaway from the episode.
Dude,
I would make Halloween, all the Halloween costume stores.
Yeah. I'd buy them just to burn them and make it like, you know, be like happy
Halloween.
You're still
giving them money. You're still giving them money when you burn it. Yeah.
True. I'll steal it. Got it. I'm good at that.
Yeah. I definitely, or, like, you know what, just make up a costume. Like, in grade four, I dressed up as the princess of Pink and Purple Land, and I wore a purple dress and a pink wig, and I made myself this epic staff that I walked around all day with. Like, just do that. Like, you know, there's no reason for you to wear these costumes when there's so many characters from like animation, video games, all these things that you can be for Halloween that you do not need to take someone else's culture and use it to mock them.
But if you like if you wanted to go as an iconic Asian character, like a specific person, right? Like if you wanted to be Bruce Lee, right? Like that's totally different. I guess I just want to clarify that the costume that we're talking about is just when they like boil all of Asia down into one weirdly provocative Asian girl costume or like Asian man costume, right? But if you want to be, you know, Lucy Liu in Kill Bill, you know,
as long as you don't tape your eyes like this or like
tape your eyes.
Like just wear the clothes. Just do the clothes. We'll all get it. That's all you need.
We'll get all you need. If you do the clothes right, we'll get it. Yeah.
Hello, and welcome back to the Gender Empowerment Collective podcast. We are here with our special guest, Dr. Lenora Angeles, to continue our conversation about cultural appropriation. Hello, and welcome, Dr. Angeles. Thank you for being here today. And if you want to take a moment to introduce yourself, please do so.
Hi there. I'm Lenora Angeles, or Angeles. I'm often called Nora by my graduate students and undergrad students at UBC. I'm cross-appointed at the School of Community and Regional Planning and the Institute for Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice. And I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. We're very happy to have you. All right, so we'll just move into our first question. Chimji, do you wanna go ahead?
So I guess just to start, something that we've kind of discussed amongst ourselves and that we wanted to ask you as well was how you would go about defining cultural appropriation, like if you could. Is it even possible to apply like a stringent definition in your opinion? And where would you say like the line lies, if there is one, right, between cultural appropriation and appreciation?
Yes, it's a highly contested terminology in that we often use, cultural appropriation or misappropriation. Often is what we're really referring to. When, for instance, we take something out of its original historical context and apply its representation inappropriately to conditions or contexts that are often considered either offensive, historically revisionist, or might be infuriating or disrespectful of the cultures and peoples where those particular original cultural elements come from.
Right. So would you say that the judgment of like this, of cultural, like saying something is cultural appropriation is really dependent on those groups then?
I often see it as, who's the arbiter of this? Who are the people, the cultural heritage owners, for instance, who would call out people when they are engaged in forms of cultural appropriation that are considered offensive. And oftentimes we tend to forget that this practice exists within power dynamics.
Yeah.
And when you have a context of a power distribution that's rather asymmetrical or inequitable, then that's when you have problematic forms of cultural appropriation that sometimes happens in the name of appreciation. But again, I think the original heritage cultivators of this culture would have to be the final arbiter, not the outsiders appropriating those elements from them.
Right. Yeah, that's something that I really agree with. I mean, because I see a lot of when people do call out like instances of cultural appropriation, like the minority group in particular, there is a lot of like there's a lot of people responding and saying that it's just appreciation, right? And that's particularly annoying for me as well.
And I think we really have to be very clear with the process. So for instance, when let's say indigenous spiritual beliefs are misappropriated by non-indigenous peoples, then we call it what it is, cultural appropriation. In some cases, the reverse doesn't happen. So for instance, when indigenous people or cultural minority groups, let's say, convert to religions that are originally from Western traditions, then we call it the result of religious proselytization, right? And or religious conversion. And so I think we really need to understand the context and the power dynamics, such that when, let's say, this is happening in the context of colonialism, then we call it something else. And again, it suggests a certain kind of power dynamics when we say cultural appropriation, right?
Right. Yeah, I definitely agree. That's something I've learned a lot in past classes discussing power dynamics and how, like, because you always get an argument, I think, a lot of times on social media, especially from white people who are guilty of cultural appropriation, and they come back, well, like, you know, they take, you know, things from our culture. And I've seen this a lot recently, probably because we're getting close to Halloween. And I mean, first thing, white is not a culture. And it has a lot what you said about power. Like, it's, there's such a power imbalance that, like, making that argument is ignoring the context of settler colonialism, colonialism, and all that's happened throughout history and today.
Context is so important in this case, because we need to understand the conditions under which this practice is happening, and the conditions under which this is in a way commercialized. And it's not the original cultural heritage bearers who are benefiting from it, but the appropriators.
Yeah, I think that was the main, like, one of the main points that we brought up in our discussion was, like, the question of, like, who is the money going to when being appropriated.
Halloween, for instance, is interesting because when you look at contemporary Halloween in Canada and the United States, and in particular, it can really be read at many levels. And it's not just a form of cultural appropriation. We can also read these Halloween costumes and costumes as forms of cultural hybridity. There were influenced in some cases by folk costumes, beliefs, and cultural activities from Celtic speaking countries. And that is why these costumes and beliefs have pagan roots. Others are influenced by Celtic Christianity. And there are always tensions and amalgamation of folk religion and religions before Christianity. So for instance, the spread of Christianity around the world made it possible for Halloween. The original meaning, of course, you probably recall as Hallowed Evening or Holy Evening, right? And the term itself having Scottish roots for All Hallow Eve, or the day before All Hallows. And it's associated with more, you know, solemn, if not religious, commemorative observation of the dead and All Saints Day, that of course we observe in many parts of the world that have been colonized, the Day of the Dead or All Souls Day is a big thing in the Philippines, as well as many Latin American countries where there are large Christian population. So this reading of appropriation in Halloween is understandable given its historical and geographical roots.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so interesting. I personally was not aware of the roots of Halloween. I kind of just like, I guess when I like moved here, I kind of just took it as it is. So that's actually, yeah, that's super cool to know. I'm just wondering, like, what are your personal thoughts when you see like costumes that are just labeled like Asian girl or like Asian boy or something like that, and they're wearing like, often for females, like an over-sexualized like oriental, and I'm putting like air quotes around that costume, right? Like, how do you how do you feel when you like see it?
I'd like to discuss this at three levels. You've mentioned the gender dimension, which is really very important, the gender and sexuality dimension. I'll tie the first one to the cultural misappropriation that you were mentioning earlier, because contemporary popular Halloween costumes appropriate elements from various cultures that are often adopted or taken from minority, and by that I mean non-white indigenous cultures, by members of a dominant, usually white Western members of that culture. And these elements are often used outside of the original cultural context. So for example, when you see people dressing up as Pocahontas, you know, of course there is a, this whole association too with commercialization in Hollywood, this Disney certainly, it becomes now a form of spectacle, right? But also identity transgression. And I think there many ways by which this identity transgression happens, you know, during Halloween. You already mentioned gender and sexuality. Some might say that Halloween is perhaps the most queer of all our holidays and festive events, right? Because it is reminiscent of identity boundary transgression. Right. You know, there's gender role play there, gender role reversal, right? And sometimes cultural inversion too, in its cultural elements. And this is, I think, leading me to the third part, because in you know, other cultures, for instance, where Halloween is really more of a remembering of the dead, this costume wearing practice is not common. And if you wear costumes, you can be, you know, dress up as something that has to be scary, right? But in this case, Halloween costumes are really, you know, from the scary ones to the more fantastical ones to you know, very gendered sexualized way. So it's part spectacle, part fantasy, but also partly playing to our contemporary culture of illusion and our culture of fear in a way. So I was reminded, you know, at a time when Ebola, and maybe we are going to be seeing some kind of a counterpart in 2020 of coronavirus theme Halloween, around the time when the Ebola virus was, you know, the scary virus of the day, you have Halloween homes complete with the house owner wearing face shields and a white protective, you know, a suit with a clipboard and a red plastic bag marked biohazard infectious ways, right? Wow. And you can even buy, you know, a sexy Ebola containment suit costumes, and including a face mask and knee-high socks, for instance. And according to this brandsonsale.com selling it at the time, it would be for fashionistas who seek a global solution to hazmat couture, right? And so this is of course playing into fear and illusion at the same time, but also there's a lot of money making things or aspects to it. You also have, of course, the more traditional ones on supernatural figures, vampires and monsters. And now, of course, we have incorporated Disney movie characters, right?
Yeah.
I remember growing up, so-called cowboys and Indians were the more common mm-hmm. ones, right?
Yeah.
And now the same thing of the us versus the enemy type of, you know, your scary enemies, where you have theme outfits around 9/11, for instance, on the white soldiers, and Arab theme mm-hmm. Outfits were popular. You know, the firefighters who went to the Twin Towers rescue operations. Those things are all kind of playing into representation of conquest, of I would say winners and losers. So part of this are,
yeah,
I think, cultural motifs and practices that are so ubiquitous right now, like our cosplay. You probably know people who before the pandemic, you know, who are into costume play.
Yeah.
And then of course our avatars on our online games and our virtual lives in cyberspace. So this plays into the everyday fantasy and how best to magnify that than on Halloween night.
Yeah. So I think that we're just going to switch gears a little bit, but it's still keeping with the theme. But
sure.
We just are wondering, we had a point come up in our conversation earlier about how the media perpetrates everything that we've been talking about. So like right now with COVID, we've seen a huge rise in racism against Asians, specifically East Asians. And so we're just wondering if you could provide some insight about like how the media tends to like perpetrate these ideas about Asians by like the minimization of this racism that's enacted against them. And so one of the things that we've thought about is like the model minority myth. Can you just speak a bit to that point?
You know, I'm not a media expert by any means. Mm-hmm. I don't do communication studies as a specialization. Mm-hmm. I am really speaking here more as a kind of a generalist social scientist, feminist scholar. Mm-hmm. And so I will defer to people who are more into media communication studies to really give more sound analysis of the answer to your question. From my perspective, mm-hmm. What we have seen right now with media mm-hmm. is, I would say, it's significant contributing role to the increased political mm-hmm. and cultural polarization, particularly in countries, white settler countries in particular, Canada, US, I'd say Australia, where you have the rise of white supremacist beliefs, for instance. Mm-hmm. And more largely populist authoritarianism that has led to the rise of right-wing parties in many parts of the world, not just in the global north, but also in the global south. Certainly, no thanks to, and there are many different types of media. You have mm-hmm. Still a very sizable, respectable media that's into investigative journalism. And that type of media has certainly been under attack because we have seen this emergence of kind of anti-elite media establishment sentiments from what used to be in on the fringes, but have now been mainstream through Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, like all of these things that used to be, as I said earlier, underground, fringe. You think of 4chan, for instance. You think of Breitbart, you know, and certainly Facebook is not fringe at all. It's very mainstream. But imagine all of the revenue that they generated, for instance, when in the last presidential elections, for instance, and how they use algorithms basically to really target Facebook users. And it's quite interesting that besides those with drug addictions, we call them users, right? Because it's really so addictive. And I want your readers, listeners to watch The Social Dilemma, because it's a documentary film available on Netflix that really tells us about the current dilemma that we have. And so when you have the rise of racism during, I would say, at the time when news about what's happening in Wuhan, China, and then you have the leader of the most powerful country in the world calling it the China virus. That is very problematic. When we call or associate a country and its people with a particular microbial viral organism, right? It is unforgivable when we use this terminologies. So. But it's beyond terminologies. It is. I think going at our baser instincts that comes around when people really feel threatened.
Yeah.
And when the threat can origins, in this case, beyond our borders, can be exploited for political gains, then that's when we really have a big problem. And when you have the genie out of the bottle, so to speak, it's so hard to put it back, right? And this is why I think people will be watching what's happening in the coming elections, because what I think we're reaping right now with our increased political and cultural polarization is that it's harder to talk across our differences. Mm-hmm. It's so much harder for people to really feel empathy that we are really no different from the next person sitting beside us or the person across, you know, our seat, you know, on the bus or the people that we try that some forms of media try to demonize, right? We are all part of the same human race, of the same humanity, you know, with very similar hopes and dreams for a better life and for more hopeful future for our children, for better social and economic equality. So again, if there's anything, it's this trust erosion and empathy decline that is the that are the results of what we're seeing right now in this intense competition among media outlets for our increasingly shorter time attention time span.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. Like I heard that on like someone on a different podcast, like put it as like, we've lost the ability to kind of do three things with the other person, which is like wonder about like their situation and put yourself in their shoes, and then to empathize, but then also to like critique what they're doing as well. And yeah, I think that you put that very well. and to me, I think it's been really scary. Like I'm Mongolian, and it's been really scary to see like all these like anti-Asian attacks happen, and also like crazy to think that like when whatever the perpetrator of this like attack is like seeing this one Asian person as like their fear like projected onto this Asian person, and then also kind of like holding them responsible for this, what isn't even the actions of this country, you know, like of like China, right? So like I think for me, it also kind of like connects back to how like I feel like certain minorities are like, well, sometimes I feel, sorry, this is kind of all over the place, but sometimes I feel like when I'm the only like Asian person in a room with just like other white people, I feel like I'm kind of representing my whole like race. And I think that that's kind of the same, like where minorities are kind of held to represent a whole group of people just on their own, and that same thing isn't applied to white people.
I mean, this, and again, we could have a whole show on this intersection of race, ethnicity, nationality, gender. Certainly Asian immigrants in the US and in Canada had been in a way positively, if I may make a distinction between negative and positive stereotypes, but they're stereotypes nevertheless, right? Which often don't represent the real lived experiences of each and every individual who belongs to that group. So this Asians as the ideal minority in a way had been used against Blacks. And Latinx, right? And somehow in among Asian American organizations, for instance, embracing this positive stereotypes, right, of this the Asian tech entrepreneur, right, the nerdy math wizard, and the hardworking valedictorian, right, in class, we kind of tend to forget that as we elevate ourselves, who are we also putting down? And even among Asians, there are also kind of hierarchies that we create. For instance, we those positive stereotypes rarely apply, for instance, to Laotian or Cambodians, right? So class definitely, you know, is almost becoming like a how do you call that, class position, in a way trumps race. In some cases, and there is always an association of particular racial groups with certain socioeconomic positionalities. And this is why it's so hard to separate the two. And then you add on gender, right? And you've probably seen a lot of this representations that are dominant in media, particularly prior to COVID-19. It seemed like ages ago when Crazy Rich Asians, right, was among the top grocers, and yet we also do see Asian Americans, for instance, who did not feel quite right with the way they are represented in the movie, right? So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that when you think about how Asians in the US or in Canada got elevated to the Crazy Rich Asians, buyers of monster homes that had caused the unaffordable housing crisis here in Vancouver, to potential purveyors of the Corona COVID-19 virus, right?
Yeah.
You could really see how fragile and unstable those representations are in media, in everyday life, and in our collective imagination. Mm-hmm. And those are not, I would say, stereotypes and representations that happen overnight. They are also shaped historically, because we don't remember anymore the time when, for instance, Chinese and other Asians, particularly Filipinos, were no better than Blacks. As represented in our law, in American laws, for instance. And there was a very interesting solidarity in around the late 19th century between the Black and the Chinese community, many of them intermarrying with each other. But of course, today, that's not the case. You have a lot of anti-Black stereotyping and racism among within the Asian community, not just in Asia but also in the diaspora. And so that is problematic. But when you think about, again, skin color and ethnicity or nationality, it was just probably not too long ago when Italians and Irish were not seen as whites in the United States, right?
There
was a lot of anti-Irish and anti-Italian sentiments, you know, and that has nothing to do at the time, really, with the fact that they're also Europeans. It's about their association with certain types of occupation and with socioeconomic status. Right? So I remember, for instance, you know, Irish Canadians who will never forget how they were seen as the dirty Irish immigrants who were potato farmers from the old world and taking away their jobs for much less than the wages that they're used to. So again, when did the Irish became white, right? Or when did the Chinese suddenly become this mega millionaires that non-Chinese now fear are taking over the world? And you have leaders, of course, taking advantage of that fear. which for sure is going to get resurrected this Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely, I believe you mentioned this a little bit earlier, Jimji, about how like when you are the only Asian person in a room with white people, like you're expected to represent that entire continent of people. And I think that's something that we don't recognize enough. And even for me as a white student in GRSJ at UBC, I find myself constantly doing that because like constantly relying on people of color in my life to provide me with their lived experiences, their anecdotes about their life, which just plain isn't fair because that's millions and millions of people that live on that continent. And there's no way that one person can speak, and it's not right to expect that. So I think that is really like interesting to see how that, like the framing of Asian as a monolith and just one type of person relates to like those myths that we have and the stereotypes that we have. And then again, to the costumes that we have as part of Halloween, where we have costumes that are Asian girl, Asian boy. So it's interesting to see how all of these parts connect and they all relate to one another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sadly, you know, the Halloween is the time, right, for all of this narrow representations and hypersexualized and gender stereotypical costumes, and in some cases hyper feminine or hyper masculine, right, representations that we will see. And again, just like in real life, those representations rarely exist.
Yeah, I think, I guess just being mindful of time, I guess I just wanted to say, like, thank you so much for being here on this podcast. You've definitely touched on like so many topics, but I guess that makes sense because everything's interconnected. But it was really nice to hear about this from a perspective like kind of beyond our own, like just me, Randy, and the other girl on this podcast. Yeah.
We're really happy to have you on our podcast so we can get just an additional perspective. If you want to give any sort of final thoughts to our topic, and then we'll be finished with the interview.
Just like in schools, in our universities, in a way, there's almost like a hidden curriculum, right, in our time-honored traditions, like Halloween, for instance. And I think, I don't want to be a killjoy by saying, you know, don't go out there. Of course, we have to be mindful of all the safety protocols and social distancing and all that. But if we so decide to have a particular costume or as a way to celebrate or observe Halloween, I think we need to really think more critically as to where our ideas are coming from, who shaped them, and how we can in fact use perhaps this identity transgression and alteration as a way to exercise our critical thinking and make a statement or a critique of the things that we find problematic in our society right now. So thank you so much for your invitation. And anytime if you want me on your show, please do invite me. I'm just an email away.
We will definitely do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Gender Empowerment Collective podcast. We can be reached at genderempowerment@citr.ca for your comments and feedback. Until next time, music by Hero.